Welcome to Technology Tangents. We get leaders together to discuss the important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. As always, our host, Jason Goth. Welcome back, Jason.
Hey, Vincent.
How are you today?
I'm great.
Did you do some fishing over the weekend?
I did. I fished in a tournament and got killed.
Well, that's a start anyway. You got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Someday a robot will do that better, hopefully.
Yeah, let's hope not.
Well, speaking of robots and taking over the world, I want to talk about ChatGPT, these large language models that everybody's talking about these days. And in particular, I want to talk about the legal ramifications of those models. There's a lot of cases out there today with questions about who owns copyrights. Is it copyrightable? What happens if your copywritten image is actually used in these models? Who has claims to all of this? A topic that Jason and I are obviously very qualified to discuss.
Completely unqualified to talk about.
Unqualified is actually the truth here. So we actually have a special guest joining us today, Adam Floyd. Adam has tried and handled cases before the Federal District Court in over 20 states, the Federal Circuit, the ITC, the PTAB, arbiters and mediators for plaintiffs and defendants of all sizes and types. This experience, coupled with his experience as a judge at the U.S. Patent Trial and Appeals Board, the PTAB, provides him with the ability to see patent cases from all angles and establish effective strategies for his clients. He's also an arbiter of the American Arbitration Association and therefore grossly overqualified for having this discussion today with two Neanderthals like Jason and I, at least when it comes to law. So welcome, Adam.
Thank you, Vince.
Appreciate
welcome.
It.
Yeah, and see, I wasn't even sure what PTAB was. That's how unqualified I am to have this discussion.
So we can get down to brass tacks here. I really want to talk about what this stuff means from a legal standpoint, and I know this is an evolving area, but you're reading, you know, when we read the news today, you're seeing people all over the place talk about how AI is going to take marketers and artists and all the creative people and put them out of work. And maybe that's true. Probably not. Maybe not. We'll see. But, you know, AI is here and it's raising all kinds of ethical and legal questions around these topics. So should AI be able to get a copyright of its own work? Should, I don't know what that would mean, first of all, like, what does that mean? Who would own that? How would you pay for that, et cetera? If AI doesn't own it, then who does own the copyright? And what if you're using, again, copyrighted material in the training of that AI? Is that okay? Is it not okay? What if I were able to create an entire movie with Brad Pitt and it looks exactly like him, sounds exactly like him, and yet he's not paid for it? I think these are the kinds of things. You know, by the way, I just saw this too. David Guetta, is that how you say his name? The DJ artist? Guetta? Anyway.
I'm not sure.
Anyway, the DJ guy. He recently just created a song that actually has Eminem's exact likeness and voice saying things that Eminem has certainly never said for the sake of his song. And so again, my point is, like, this stuff is real. These sort of large language models are really going to change everything.
You see, what we like to do, Adam, is like ask you 15 or 20 questions all at once, all right, and then you have to answer them. Remember them in order and answer them.
That's exactly right. So, okay, let's get started for real, though. And maybe we just start off with the easiest of them, I suspect, based off our little bit of research we could find online here. And that is, can AI own a copyright?
So there are really two questions. You asked about ownership, but I think also first you would talk about authorship.
Okay.
So AI cannot be an author of a work.
And what does that mean, authorship?
So whoever wrote, so before we get into the complicated things, something simple, if somebody wrote a book, that's the author of the book.
Okay.
So that's a different question than ownership. So I could write the book, but then I could give you the rights to the book. You would own the copyright, even though you're not the author. So in the case of AI, AI cannot do either one of those two things.
Okay.
And the reason it can't is because of the way the statute is written and has been interpreted by the courts. An author under copyright has to be a human being. And likewise for patents, an inventor has to be a human being, according to the courts. And I think that will probably stand because of the way the statutes are drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't mean that Congress can't amend the statute in the future, especially if they're lobbied by your industry and I'm sure, receive, you know, adequate compensation.
They can certainly be persuaded. Certainly the, you know, in the tech industry, and I'm sure other countries probably have similar statutes as well. And again, that's maybe something we can get to kind of at the end of this. I want to get through all of the other questions, but it's like that. It seems like such a patchwork, different thing with all the different states and governing bodies, I guess, you know, countries, and you know, maybe extra country like the EU and that kind of stuff as well. So,
yeah, it's a good point. Look, you know, Microsoft just invested $10 billion in OpenAI. What's, you know, a couple hundred million then to spend on lobbyists? Not a big deal if that's really the commercial appetite there.
So. But I don't want to get into that now because we have Adam here, and that's, you know, he's probably not, he's looking at me like, oh, I don't want to talk about EU law. I don't, you know, but like, we'll focus it on the US right now, but we can talk about that later, Vincent.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. So authorship and ownership, two distinct things. And as it stands, AI can do neither of those two things.
Yeah, so ownership would be an interesting thing because how can a computer program own anything?
Yeah.
It can enter into a contract.
Right.
So the very essence of a contract is the meeting of minds. So we agree upon something. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe one day you'll have a computer that actually can be sentient and have a will and do all sorts of things like that.
Hopefully not. Yeah.
But certainly we're not anywhere near there now. So they can enter contracts. And so one of the issues, if you do change the law, that would have to be definitely would be addressed. Because if they, so for example, South Africa, you asked about other countries, actually has ruled that AI can be an inventor on patents. The EU and UK and the rest of the world so far has said no. So then the question is, well, if the computer is the inventor, well, who owns the invention? Right. And we'll see what they do with that.
That's really interesting.
I wonder, would it be, you know, let's say Microsoft or Google, whomever, owns an AI, and they, you know, it's essentially a tool they use to create an invention or a work, and would it then move to the owner of the AI? Much like, you know, I don't know, this may be a terrible analogy, tell me if this is crazy, but if I'm like, I'm using a tool, you know, even if I write software, I'm still using a tool to write it, right? A computer to write it. And so I own it. So if it could be used as a tool like that, I guess but the question then would be then open source, like, you know, stuff like ChatGPT, which is right, you know, originally open source. Like, well, who owns the open source? Nobody, I guess.
One, and maybe who owned the data sets that trained the system, and or is it the person who trained the system, the same person that's using the system? So it seems like there's a lot of different ownership issues that could arise.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, like you could train it, but not use it.
Right. And I think like this, we'll come back to this in a minute, but I do want to, you know, I think there is some interesting analogies with like photography. And if you invent a camera, if you will, and then if a photographer then uses said tool, said machine to create a piece of art or just take a photo in general, that person sort of de facto gets the copyright of that. And so I think there's an interesting analogy here. Like, is that the same or is all of the creative expression in the model creation itself? I don't know. I think it's a good argument on both sides, but we'll come back to that. Let me just circle back real quick though, around this idea of sort of personhood. And the thing to your point is like, let's say that an AI could own the copyright. What would that mean? Well, corporations do this though, right? So there's corporate personhood and they can enter contracts and they can be treated as effectively an entity with, I don't know, will. I don't know what the criteria are exactly, yeah, but that does exist today. Does that feel different to you? Or
No, that's a great question. The difference is that it depends upon the statute. So in some of these cases that have addressed this issue, that has been raised as an argument. Well, corporations can be treated as people, so why can't you treat AI as people? And the answer is, well, because that's not what the statute says. The statute says human being. The corporate statute specifically says corporations. Other statutes specifically say companies, corporations, and, you know, they list out who's eligible for protection.
I see.
And the Copyright and Patents Acts were written, the word they use is individuals, which the courts have interpreted to mean that means a human being.
So it's literally just explicitly stated in the statute itself.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's not that, again, you mentioned Congress could write, it's not that you couldn't use that analogy and draft a law, I guess, that would make that so. Really the issue is like, that is not what they say today. And so we have to go by what they say today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It would be a relatively easy thing for them to amend those statutes to allow for AI, both authorship and ownership, and address those issues. It's just a matter of whether and when they're going to, be pushed into doing that.
Yeah, just love to get your opinion. Do you think that will happen, that they will amend those?
I think it's inevitable they'll have to. I mean, as AI becomes more and more prominent and generates more pieces of work, you're going to want those works protected if you're the one investing money into these systems to develop things. And so I think you were going to lobby Congress to make changes.
Yeah, I mean, this goes to an interesting angle, which is really, what is the purpose of copyright and patent law in general? Like, what are the commercial interests that Congress was trying to protect and the behaviors they were trying to incent?
Yeah, so the purpose of copyright and patents is actually stated in the Constitution itself, and it's to promote sciences and arts, sciences on the patent side and arts on the copyright side. So you can argue about sort of what that means, because just like in the patent area, you can imagine if you allowed AI to obtain copyrights, you could generate trillions of copyrightable images, for example, probably overnight using some of these systems, and basically just try to shut out, huge swaths of work where, music would be a great example because music is mathematically based. Mm-hmm. So it's not just random. So you could teach a system, which I guess they already are teaching these things.
Correct.
To generate music, what we would consider good music. You could generate it at a rate that no human could match. And then you could end up with so many copyrighted works that no matter what you produce, you're probably going to violate one of my trillions of copyrights.
Right. Yeah, it's a really interesting trouble then. It's this natural tension that exists that there could be a bad actor who tries to, in the same way patent trolls did, I guess not even a decade ago, tried to buy up all the little essences of patents so that they could then sue on bigger, sort of more transformative technologies. In that maybe I just go create every possible image or every possible song and every possible chord progression, copyright those, and now you've blocked an entire area of innovation.
Yeah, that's what they, so in the patent area, they tried to do that with the Human Genome Project, where they took all the genes, because there's only a fixed number, and using computers, even though it's a large number, you could sequence all those genes and get a patent on each one, which then blocks every sort of work in that field.
Yeah.
Well, what happened in that instance?
In that instance, they did obtain a lot of the patents, and then some universities, seeing the danger in this, began doing the same thing and then not getting patents on them, but releasing them, showing that we invented this, therefore you can't get a patent. No one can get a patent on it. But nevertheless, that company still owns millions of patents covering many, many genes.
Yeah, there's this big race. It was, I don't remember what it was called, but yeah, this big race to sequence the human genome. And it was like an independent, firm, private firm, and then a bunch of research institutions, consortium of research trying to then get, they were racing. It was like, who could do it first, because it would have huge implications downstream. And I think that the other half of the tension then is, look, if you are, let's say you're a pharmaceutical company, and you're trying to synthesize new proteins, you're trying to understand how proteins fold. Well, we've just seen with AlphaFold and some other technologies that have come out recently, for the first time ever, we can really do a great job of predicting how these things are going to fold and come together. You can imagine the very next step of this process is, well, then go create a million different types of antibodies or proteins or whatever it happens to be, and then figure out how they're going to bond or where they're not going to bond, which, again, would be amazing for the sake of research. On the other hand, if by using those systems you then prohibit those pharmaceuticals from getting patents, that's going to be problematic. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you say that you can get patents, then a bunch of firms are going to go try and just like suck up all the foundational elements of these and prohibit real innovation unless they get some sort of fee effectively.
Yeah, I mean, I think they would not block it. They would just license you. Yeah. And so then you basically have created layers of tax, additional taxes, so to speak, on the consumers. So you have to pay a tax to this guy because he has this patent or this other patent, and then you pay the company that for developing the drug,
right?
And it just becomes more expensive. And of course, if you have a blocking patent, you know, depending on the value of the drug, that royalty could be really substantial.
Sure. Well, and if you're the last man standing, as it were, right, which is they've already acquired licensing for everything else required, and this drug is going to be transformative, trillion, $100 million, whatever, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. You could say, well, I want 90% of your profit, right, and they're basically stuck. Yeah, that's really tricky. So just to back up a little bit here, today, as it stands, as legislation is written, at least in this country, again, South Africa might be different, but at least in the U.S., and it sounds like in England and the EU as well.
Yeah, in Australia.
In Australia, okay. Today, in all those countries, AI can't do any of these things.
Correct.
And that means, as you think about things like ChatGPT, which is a good, this if you haven't seen it, it's great. Go million podcasts, million videos, go check it out. But in essence, you can ask it to create entire prompts or design entire web pages or entire blogs. People are using this all over the place to optimize marketing, to get true personalization. We have some clients today that effectively write hotel descriptions that are personalized for a business user. And so a business traveler cares about what conference center, location to city center, location to Starbucks, in my case, things of this nature. And so the prompt then describes the hotel in those terms. A family traveler cares more about the pool and the amenities and the, you know, size of the bathroom or whatever they happen to care about. My question then is, if you use these tools to create those today, as written in all those countries, none of that is copyrightable, which is typically how marketing material specifically is protected. So if I create an ad, and whether it be a digital ad, whether it be text, whether it be a movie, a commercial spot, whatever, nobody can just take it, steal it, and post it on their webpage with their logo because it's copyrighted.
Right.
And as a tendency, if they use those technologies, in all cases then, is that instantly like, too bad, so sad you don't own a copyright?
Yeah. I mean, maybe in some ways, maybe it's what we want, because what did it cost you to generate that?
Yeah.
I mean, it really didn't cost you anything, so is it really fair for you then to be able to sue somebody to keep them from copying what you didn't yourself create?
Mm-hmm. And that's where... That makes a lot of sense, yeah, from a commercial standpoint, but this goes to the sort of slippery slope in my mind, which is, mm-hmm. Well, today, again, marketers use all sorts of tools to expedite their process and reduce the cost. So, you know, if you watch Mad Men back in the day in the 50s, right, like these people were on their drawing tables in a room and writing out each character by hand, and what an amazing skill, by the way. Jake Carter, by the way, I've seen him do that, like literally like draw entire alphabets by hand, incredible. But of course, now we use Photoshop or Illustrator or all these tools that do that instantly and, you know, for free nominally. I mean, compared to what it used to cost, basically for free. So if people can use computers like Photoshop and they receive copyrights for the work, how is this different in your mind?
So it's really a matter of degree.
Okay.
Because obviously AI is still just a tool. It's not thinking for itself. So the question is, what have you added to it? How much creativity did the human put into the process?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the test. As you can imagine, that's not a very clear...
Yeah, what
not
is
a
the,
very clear line, right?
What is the minimum amount of creativity exactly. required here?
So, whatever it is, you've seen me draw. if it's an art project, I'll be below whatever the minimum level is.
Yeah. So on one extreme, we know, like if I told you, hey, Vince, I want you to go draw me a picture of, you know, a monkey in an astronaut suit doing something crazy on, you know, on a bicycle or whatever. And you go off and you create that. We know that you would have the copyright in that because the idea, while mine, is not protectable. It's the expression of the idea that's protected. And it's your expression because you drew it. So to some extent, I guess if you're telling a computer to do that, well, that's not enough. You didn't add enough creativity to the expression. You, all you did was give it an idea. But of course, you know, there's a lot of gray area in between.
It's a really good, it's a really good call out, which is the idea itself is not protectable. And effectively, that's what we're asking in these cases. I have the idea to create some piece of art or some copy that's going to serve some purpose. And I might have a unique perspective on how to accomplish that. But I'm not actually expressing any of it. I'm asking the computer to express it. And the expression is the critical part of protection, it sounds like.
Yeah, so copyrights only protect the expression of an idea. So a patent would protect basically the utility of an idea. So a patent also cannot just protect an idea. You can't say, well, I want a patent on a flying car. That's just an idea.
Sure.
And even if you built a flying car, you can't say, well, I want a patent on any flying car. You can only get a patent on your model of a flying car, your utility.
Got it. That's really interesting. So in this case, you know, if I go back to this analogy of Photoshop and I'm using it, let's say, you know, maybe it's pure digital art. So everything was created in Photoshop in this case. I have an idea. I'm going to do a monkey, space monkey on a bike. Your point is, well, that's fine. Nobody cares. As soon as I then take my cursor and move it around the screen to create said, to realize, to express that idea, that that we're good with.
Yeah.
I guess the question then that's still a little bit tricky here is, you know, what is it? Is a cursor moving enough? The answer is yes. Or a pen on my touchscreen? Yes. Well, what if it only had to do fewer motions? So for example, there's some like interesting content to wear fill stuff. So I could sort of take a marker and I could sort of cover half, you know, a third of my photo because I understand thirds. That's about all I know in my photography skills here. And I could say, okay, well, here, take this third and put in mountains. And take this third and put in dirt. And take this third and put in water. Well, it turns out that these machines now can actually take that, you know, literally just solid color and actually express what mountains really look like with shading and color and all of those things. Is that enough, do you think, or not quite enough? Do I have to get even deeper?
Do I have to pick the colors and, and that kind of stuff? Like this is like really fascinating because, I mean, there's so much, you know, so much detail. Like, where is that line?
Yeah, I mean, to me, just a gut reaction, to me, that does not feel like enough because that feels more like cut and paste.
Yeah.
So if you wanted the monkey and you go online and you say, oh, here's a picture of a monkey in an astronaut suit. Great. I'm going to paste that into my thing. And I'm going to go find a picture of a bicycle and paste that in there and then make a few little changes or whatever. Have you really created an expression? Probably not. And that's what that feels like. Your example feels more like that.
Yeah. So if I take this from another tact then, and I think about photography as an example. So I could take, you know, those same, a monkey, maybe I have a little toy monkey. I'm sure there's one on my floor somewhere in my house and, you know, put them on a bicycle in a little space suit. Again, like that's just an idea. As soon as I take a photo of that though, now the photo is protectable, right?
Yeah.
And probably. I only assembled like some random things together, put it on top of it, like great. So now we're in a place where, well, photography, I mean, that's sort of a lot of cases there, right? There's several cases that have shown photography is, and help me understand, like, why are photographs allowed to be protected?
Well, so the original case goes back to, like, the late 1800s when photography was new. I think it was called lithography back then. So the courts at that time, the first court looked at it and said, no, that's not protectable. Because you're not creating it. This machine, which obviously they didn't really understand, is creating it. And the Supreme Court said, no, that is copyrightable because It was a picture of Oscar Wilde, and the photographer posed him. He was the one that told him what to wear. He was the one that adjusted the lighting and made all these decisions about how he was going to take that photograph. And therefore, that was enough expression, human expression, to protect it, even though obviously you're using a machine and the machine does certain things for you mm-hmm. that he would not be able to do on his own. That would be considered protected. Now, photography's come a lot farther. So a lot of those decisions you don't make, right? It can adjust the aperture and it adjusts your shutter and it adjusts your focus automatically. And
it even stitches them together now with high dynamic range. It'll take four and then stitch them together automatically, right?
But I think I do see somewhat of a distinction there, you know, when you talk about like what to wear and how to pose. And you know, if you took 10 photographers and you said, hey, we're going to have 10 photographers do a photo shoot of Vincent Yates, like all the pictures come back entire, like there's no commonality. Whereas I think with it, the argument might be, well, if people give the AI the same prompt, they get the same, in theory, would get the same answer. So do you provide enough detail into the prompt of like, posed this way with this on? Where is that line about what is sufficient enough to be an expression? If I understand you right, that's where the rub is, where is that line? It's how much is an actual expression.
That's exactly right. And I think, unfortunately, because of the way the test is designed, and it's not uncommon in law, the test basically is, well, I know it when I see it. Mm-hmm. And that test is reoccurring throughout many areas of law. And I guess whether that's a good test or a bad test depends upon your faith in your fellow man, right. Whether they're good decision makers or poor decision makers.
Yeah. Well, but I do think there's sort of two ways that you can take that, Jason, and expand it. So there's two points in time to me that there's a lot of potential creativity, good arguments towards creativity. The first is at the training itself. So for example, as a data scientist, I have to decide what training data goes into said model. I have to decide how that is labeled, like what's good, what's bad, right? Like there's a lot of sort of creativity that takes place in there. I have to decide what's the topology of that model. What are the hyperparameters that I'm going to tune? How do I tune them? What are the stair for? There's a loss function, et cetera. There's a lot of sort of things that I must decide that feel very analogous to a photographer saying, well, I'm going to choose this f-stop, or I'm going to use this kind of lens because I want this kind of depth of field. Again, like intentionally making these decisions because you want some specific output. So that's the first place that I feel like there is a lot of human creativity. And I guess if this were upheld, in that case, you'd say, well, the owner of the model, the creator of the model, is the one who did all the creative work on this, and therefore they should own the copyrights conceptually.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a follow-up question to that? That is, I think, one viewpoint, or I guess another viewpoint could be in that the creator of the model, I guess we're kind of switching to the creators and training of the models, but like that to me is more an invention, like I'm inventing the camera, right? As opposed to the model being a creative work, more of an invention. But I don't know. What are your thoughts? Like, is that, if it's Vince's interpretation more accurate or mine?
No, I think that's, so it's, yes, you can treat AI under patent. You can get a patent on AI systems, similar to getting a patent on the camera. So I think Vince's question, though, is, well, what if you made the system in such a way that it's essentially creating what you're using it as a tool, as a means to create what your expression is.
Gotcha.
So in the extreme example, if you made the system and said, well, I'm going to make a system and this system's going to draw this one picture, that to me would be clearly, yes, you would own that copyright. You just used it as a tool, the same as if you took a paintbrush and did it. The question is, when you make these other systems that are broad, where you don't necessarily know what the output's going to be.
Right.
You know, is that really your expression?
Yeah, it's really tough. And so again, so just to recap that, what I heard you say is the actual creation of the AI itself, that's patentable. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, Jason, like that's the camera, that's the apparatus, if you will, that's able to let people express all their ideas. In the case where you've built a bespoke one for your specific thing, let's say I've again started from the ground up. I'm not using any third-party service from the ground up. I've designed a system that writes the perfect copy, for example, if I were doing marketing material, the perfect copy or generate the perfect image that art gallery will buy, whatever that happens to be. In that case, again, it feels a bit like I've created a tool to facilitate what I'm trying to accomplish. And that feels like a pretty normal thing to do. Like, well, I've created a new easel that holds the paper up higher, or I've created a new paintbrush that lets me get this particular texture. That feels pretty normal to me.
Yeah.
But then that you went exactly where I was going to go next, which is, but what if I created it in a way that it can not just do the picture I was trying to create, but it can also do 87 million other types of pictures? I mean, I think there was a great number, more like orders of magnitude more than the number of atoms in the universe that these machines could create.
Right.
And so then the question is like, is that okay? Are there any analogies where somebody's created some general purpose thing that can do lots of stuff and that was all protected?
Yeah. So yes and no. So back to the camera example. So a camera is such a machine, if you think about it, because mm-hmm. it's not limited to a portrait of Oscar Wilde. You can take it and use it to take a picture of anything. Mm-hmm. And so those works are protected. And I guess the question, if you want to use that and say, okay, well, why isn't AI a tool like the camera? I guess it depends on how much input you put into it. So if you chose to take a landscape, you chose the time of day, and you chose the angle, and even if you didn't choose the f-stops and all that, you did make a lot of choices about what you put into the frame and that sort of thing. So I guess if you did the same to an AI system, if you put enough expression in there, at some point it will be protectable.
Yeah. Where that is.
Where that is kind
undecided.
Of.
Yeah,
that's the $1 million question, it sounds like.
I think it's probably with at least a B on the end of that.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah, but at least $1 billion question.
Here's the breakdown on that, though, that I see is, which is, again, if you think about the camera example, to your point, every expression of that is protectable, but notice not by the person that created the camera, by the people who used the camera.
Right.
And so in this case, I guess what we're saying is if you use that analogy, then Microsoft and Google, the people who are actually funding the model development, while patentable as a system, the output of that would not be copyrightable to them, be theoretically copyrightable to the person who created or used said apparatus for the expression of their ideas.
Right.
Which leads me to the second part of the question, which is, okay, so now let's say we use ChatGPT or whatever the model happens to be, large language or diffusion, table diffusion, et cetera, to create something. If I just ask it for a picture of a monkey and it draws a picture of a monkey, that feels like pretty low bar. Now, to your point, if I ask it for a picture of this particular type of monkey with this color fur at this angle in a light, this kind of lighting, which, by the way, you can do on Stable Diffusion. You can give it a huge number, you know, shallow depth of field, lighting, diffuse, smoky, blurry, all these things. At some point, it feels like that should certainly be protectable. I mean, it's at least as much expression as using a camera.
Yeah, at some point, it should be. I mean, so I guess I'd be more comfortable saying it's protectable if you started there, you took the generated image, you put it into Photoshop, and then you change the lighting and you change the colors and you change things you didn't like about it. Then I would be comfortable saying what you end up with is copyrightable.
Yeah. For our customers that do a lot of system development, for example, if there was an AI that said, like, design a web page that did this, you know, if they take that output and then they're like, okay, well, I'm going to make this, you know, it's a starter point, it's a template, and say, well, I'm going to make this code a little more efficient or convert that into use our button library or whatever, that would certainly, you think, qualify as a copyrightable thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I think just to that point, you know, Galileo.ai or Galileo AI effectively has just this, right? Which is effectively you can ask it to create entire web design or entire application design. So a mobile app, for example, and be like, oh, I want a landing page that looks like this. And it'll just generate it from top to bottom. And like, oh, I want to have some payment flow that looks like this. And it'll just generate it from top to bottom. Now you can imagine if you had this as your UI element and you take this into Figma, make it clickable, you could ask the same thing. And we saw this at the Microsoft Ignite conference when they first had OpenAI on, where basically they created the game of Asteroid through just conversation. Oh, I want to have some, you know, logo that moves, or the spaceship that moves up and down. And I want to take this image, and if it hits, then like that's bad and die or whatever. So they just describe through language. So you can imagine putting these two things together, and what you end up with is this end-to-end process where all you're doing is having a conversation effectively with a computer about what things you want, the flow of it, and you end up with an application at the end of the day. Seems like you're out of a job, Jason.
Yeah. Fortunately, I'm close to the retirement age, so I'm going to try to retire before that happens. No.
So I want to scare you a little bit here and just think about the enforceability of this, which is to say, recently there was somebody who basically published an entire comic book that was generated by AI, and they received a copyright on that. No big deal. Copyright office was very happy with it. No issues. Because again, they didn't disclose that it was created by a machine.
Right.
Well, later on, it comes out that they disclosed it was written by a machine, and now the copyright office is, you know, very upset about all this. And so to your point, like, it seems more like a spectrum. It's not binary, like this is definitely right and this is definitely wrong. Again, we'll see how the courts ultimately respond here, but your intuition is it's somewhere in the middle. Do you feel like a comic book, like, again, this is a storyline, this is actors, is that enough, do you think? Or do you think that's not going to meet the bar?
So I don't think it'll meet the bar. So my understanding of the facts of that case is that the person who filed for the copyright drafted the story and all the words, mm-hmm. and then used a publicly available AI system to generate all of the pictures. So obviously they're not entitled to a copyright on the pictures because they didn't do anything other than use the system.
Mm-hmm.
Could they copyright the text? Sure. But it's a comic book, so probably even pretty minimal text. Most of the comic book is the pictures.
Most the expression is in the pictures themselves, you're saying. Got it. Is there ever a world in which you can just take generic things and sort of stick them together collage style, and the output of said collage is predictable?
Yes. There have been cases like that where you've probably seen pictures of, say, like a giant picture of somebody's, a famous person's face,
mm-hmm.
but if you look closely, it's made up of small pictures of something that relates to that person. And yes, those are copyrightable.
And so to me, the comic book feels a bit like that, right? Where we're taking, you know, this sort of blob over here of text, and we're taking some images over here, and I'm putting them together to make my story arc complete, and I'm putting the formatting of where they sit on the page and all those elements. Is this not just some version of a collage?
I don't think so. I mean, the collage is you're expressing your ideas through the collage in a sense, right? So if it's, say, it's a picture of MLK,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to pick the photos that you feel represent MLK or his legacy or whatever, you know, that to me is like expression.
Mm.
Whereas the comic book's more like you told a story and you just said, hey, Jason, I heard you're a good artist. Draw me all the pictures of it. Well, clearly I don't own the copyright in that,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though I wrote the story and did the text.
Yeah. I guess it's a good point. And it comes down to this question of like, well, what if I took the MLK example that you had and let's say that I had just Googled photos of MLK. So the photo, the micro photos that create the large photo mm-hmm. aren't actually ones that I selected. I literally just like grabbed the top 20,000 images of MLK when I Googled that thing. Is that still okay, do you think?
Probably, because you're going to have to arrange them in some way that then when you step back, it looks like the picture of MLK.
Yeah.
Because if you just put it arbitrarily, it's not going to look like anything. It's just going to look like a bunch of pictures.
Random photos, right? And if I used an algorithm to automatically do that, then?
Then I think you're probably not okay.
So we're right at the line here. Keep pushing. You're
like, well, now what have you really done to express? Yeah. You had an idea, is what you're saying.
I think that, you know, my takeaway from this is back to the, if they automate software developers, I'm going to go back to law school and become an IP lawyer because it sounds like there's a ton of work in litigating every, because it does sound like what you're saying is like, all of these are going to be individual case-by-case basises around where you're going to have to figure out where on that line did you fall. And it may be up to a judge or jury or you know, something like that to determine, like, okay, this one we agree is your expression, this one is not.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's not quite as problematic as it sounds because you've maybe taken thousands of pictures over the course of your life, and they're all copyrightable. But have you ever sued or thought about suing somebody? Probably not.
Right.
And so, you know, if you make your livelihood as a photographer, then yeah, it might come up. If someone copies your work out of, you know, a museum or something that is really awesome, most people aren't going to have that
right
sort of problem, if you will. Unless maybe if your photos are online and then they get scraped to train a system or for some use, some people may take exception to that.
That's a great segue to the training question, which this also really interests me around, like, what is the, you know, we talked about like the building of an AI as an invention and the, you know, the use of it and how much expression, but like, what about the training of it and the holders of that, I guess, copyright data or copyrights of that data used for training?
Yeah.
Isn't Microsoft involved in some case around GitHub Copilot?
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's some others too. So let me do the setup real quick on exactly that. You're right, it's exactly the right segue. So I want to talk about how the models are created themselves. And so we talked a little about this. That is that, you know, some data scientists will effectively go to the internet. They'll get all this data through scraping the web effectively. And then they'll decide which of these images, which of these sets of text, whatever you're generating here, will be included in the model. They'll then decide all the hyperparameters, or at least the techniques to decide the hyperparameters. They won't choose them themselves, but they'll decide all those things. And then ultimately you get the output of the model. But that first step is so critical, which is, how do I get all of the training data to feed to this model? Because that's how the model learned. Without the data, you have nothing. You have a procedure that's basically worthless, more than worthless perhaps. The question I want to start with is, some of the images here are undoubtedly copywritten works. So what does copyright actually protect?
That's a complicated question. Copyright's a really weird set of rights, exclusionary rights. So in this case, one thing it would protect is the literal copying of your image.
Okay.
So that's clearly a violation.
So if I just take an exact copy, paste it on my website, go sell a picture of that thing,
yes,
that's no good.
So if you're using it in a data set, I guess the first question is, do you actually copy the image, or do you first take the image and then reduce it to some kind of a number data set, and that number data set, which represents the image but is not actually the image,
yeah,
is what you're using. So then you didn't actually copy the image.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. And so this becomes the exact nuance of the problem, because you can imagine the answer from a statistical data science perspective is it depends. Mm-hmm. Meaning I could create a model that has so many parameters in it that I effectively store every single pixel of that image. And I'm going to represent it in binary, you know, nominally down at the disk level. But it is every single pixel of that image, and I could recreate it perfectly. In that case, I assume that's still a violation.
It would depend on whether you actually copied the image, which is, it's a subtle distinction. But if you have a picture, if you have an image, mm-hmm. say the Mona Lisa, and do you have in your computer data set a photograph of the Mona Lisa? Mm. Or do you just have a bunch of numbers?
Yeah.
Because the numbers are not a copy. Even though you could recreate the work from the numbers, it's not a copy of the work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. If we then, so Jason, keep me honest here. If I think about vectorizing an image, so if I had some digital image that I'm going to take a photo, and then I vectorize it, what we're really doing on the back end algorithmically is fitting curves to it, correct?
Right.
And so those curves are not the image, they're just the curves in the image. and they're arbitrarily precise representations of said image. It sounds like in that case, as soon as I vectorize it, as soon as I compress it in some meaningful way, I no longer, storing that is actually probably valid.
I think that's probably right, yeah.
And so if we think about a model then, in essence, that's what I'm doing. I'm extracting latent features of the image, not the image exactly, but it, you know, some part of the model might pick up on where eyes live. Oh, they're on this part of a face, and these things have eyes and these things don't have eyes. And where do eyebrows? Oh, those are actually these dark patches right above the eyes, et cetera. So it's learning all the features of a human face, for example, but it's not storing the face directly.
And potentially learning the features of different styles of representation, right? This is how those features are represented by Dali, or those features are represented by
Picasso
or someone. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so they're learning the characteristics of the images, maybe not the images themselves. So again, storing versions of that might actually be okay.
If the version is just numbers, mm-hmm. then yeah, I think that would be okay because you haven't copied the image.
Mm-hmm.
You have a representation of the image, which you've created, but you haven't actually copied the image.
A representation defined by lots of other categories, numbers, parameters mm-hmm. that you know are not part of the image itself.
Right.
Interesting. Then, what about text? Think about code. It's like, well, we have a bunch of people that go write a program to generate, you know, the first n prime numbers, right? Something like that. And so would that apply as well, right? If you're training up an AI to recognize these are programs that generate prime numbers and learning whatever characteristics about that, and then to say, write a program that generates prime numbers. Do you feel like that, if it produced the exact same output as one of the inputs, do you think that would be?
Well, so a listing of prime numbers would not be copyrightable.
A program to generate them, that's what I'm saying.
So the actual program.
The actual program itself, right. And right. So I've got many examples of programs that generate prime numbers and the AI learns. And so if I'm able to ask the AI, generate me a program which, you know, generates prime numbers, right? Would, even if it reproduces the exact output of one of those.
So if it reproduced independently?
Independently.
Without copying? No, then that's technically not a copyright violation. So to show copyright violation, one of the things you have to prove is that you actually copied it. So this has come up in the case of maps. So say you're a cartographer, you know, a map can be an expression because even though, yes, it should be the exact same size and shape and the roads and everything should be identical, you still have choices of fonts and colors and how you choose to break it up. So there are cases where somebody will sue somebody and say, hey, you copied my map and now you're selling it as your own. And they said, no, I generated this independently.
Oh, so if Vincent and I, yeah, I see what you're saying. Like, so we write the same program, we generate the exact same output. As long as we didn't copy each other, that's
and
fine.
That's not a copyright problem. And so...
Who owns the copyright? Do we both independently own a copyright to that? Are we both, because we're both authors?
Yes, if you wanted to get a copyright. Huh. So in code, what people will do is they'll put fake lines into code that are false. They don't do anything.
Oh, or even like a comment that talks to like, this is created by Jason Goth.
Yeah, but sometimes they'll put things that you can't find. So it looks like it's part of the code, but it's actually just junk.
Mm.
And so then they can look for those lines and say, oh, see, you copied my program. You didn't independently draft this up. And cartographers do the same. They'll actually introduce mistakes, deliberate errors in a map. So that if you copy it, they know which errors to look for, and they'll say, see, you...
These are like little tracers to find out
if you're copying.
Yeah,
watermarks. Name or whatever.
Yeah, watermarks, exactly. I mean, mm-hmm. Getty, there's some case right now where Getty is suing because someone, they reproduced it But I that's so interesting because they watermarked it, mm-hmm. but then it does that other, you know, what we talked about, like just learning the image, and it reproduces it. Well, it doesn't copy the watermark, and it doesn't actually look the same. It reproduced the watermark.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating. Yeah,
just learning there were some scribbles down here in red and other colors that looked generically like it and started reproducing it. By the way, I'm passing Jason my laptop here. While he was talking, I asked for it to create an application that generates prime numbers, the first n prime numbers. So you can validate that, Jason. So this goes to a really interesting question then is, can I use those images as well? So I can store them, yes, because I'm going to store representations of them. If I then use those images to learn effectively what that style is, and then I independently recreate it from the learnings of my own thinking in some sense, is that okay?
Yeah, as far as intellectual property law is concerned, it's okay. I think you might have a contract law issue.
Okay.
So depending upon, you know, where you're scraping this data from, a lot of those websites may have
terms of service that violate it.
Clicking thing that you agree to all my terms by clicking this button.
The EULAs.
some of those may say you're not allowed to scrape my images. I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, are those things? Yeah, those little contracts of adhesion. Is that what they're called? And
I would refer to it as a contract of adhesion. It is the stereotypical example of a contract of adhesion. However, courts have not found so.
Oh.
They have been enforcing those contracts, which I've never really understood. Hmm. If you read the definition of a contract of adhesion, that sounds very much like a contract of adhesion.
Got it.
You don't read it.
Can't negotiate over it.
You can't negotiate. They're very one-sided. You know, and sometimes, you know, in cases of software, you don't even see the terms of the contract until you already loaded the program.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's really too late.
So you already bought it.
That's interesting. There were some cases, you know, those cases where effectively Google is now scraping everybody's website. They're grabbing it, they're indexing it, they're correlating it, and they got sued a lot. People didn't like that initially, especially authors, publishers, because they were, in fact, in the Authors Guild case, they were actually literally reproducing pages of the book. So people, not all the pages, but like 10 pages or something. So people could see, is this a book I want to buy? At least that was the intention of it, according to Google. Were they trying to get them on the terms of service, the EULAs, or contract law questions, or was it more IP questions?
I know the author thing was one of the things they raised was copyright. Mm-hmm. And they said the courts found that it was a fair use because, which is a doctrine under copyright. Technically, that would be a copyright violation because they literally copied some pages. But there's fair use, which means it's sort of an exception. It's a defense. Yes, you violated this, but it's a defense that you can say, well, I only copied a little portion. I didn't really use it for direct commercial purposes. Like, I didn't make money by putting those pages out there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different factors that you look at as to whether that's a fair use.
I see.
But I think they also were getting in trouble about violating terms of service on some of the web pages.
Sure. Yeah, it does feel a bit like the courts will have to continue to evolve this. But so far, I mean, Google exists, and it certainly is a great service to society. So it seems that the courts and legislators in general would want to continue to allow those things. On the other hand, there are real economic interests that they should consider about the artists and the creators of this content, because if, in fact, I go create something and I put it on a web page and everybody can go scrape it and learn exactly how to recreate what I've created, that seems problematic. And I think if I were a famous actor or actress in particular, or a famous author, this would be particularly worrisome for me, because it won't be long, until, you know, I can make a movie sitting at my laptop with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie doing a spy movie.
Right.
Like, it just generated with them in it exactly, and, you know, their perfect likeness and their voices and all of those characteristics could be recreated. Now, again, the computer isn't necessarily storing their movies. It's probably not even storing their faces exactly. It's storing some representation of it. But it does seem problematic that I could then go create an entire movie that it stars famous people.
Yeah, so you couldn't legally do that. So you do have intellectual property protection for likenesses.
Okay.
So it protects you from doing exactly what you just said. So it's illegal for me, for example, to even hire an actor that looks like Brad Pitt and try to pass him off as Brad Pitt.
Oh, interesting. I didn't really. So all the impersonation stuff.
That's like if it's normally parody.
I see.
So there's an exception for like parodies because you're, and especially if they're public figures, you have to put up with being made fun of. So.
I see. So parodies are allowed in that case. Okay. Huh. That's really interesting. So again, if you're like a marketer or a CMO or something, and you're thinking about this technology, it sounds like the stuff that comes out of these machines, at least under legislation today, without some clever reasoning of some attorneys that we have yet to see, is probably not protected. Using other people's information to train these models might be problematic, might fall under fair use. Hard to say. That one seems a little bit more nebulous. And then if I were to want to, say, create a campaign with Beyonce, but not actually pay Beyonce, probably not going to be allowed in this case.
Right. I mean, okay. You could definitely use somebody that's sort of sings in her style and all that. But if you basically try to pass her off as Beyonce, you're gonna have a problem.
Got it. So this song that I mentioned in the intro of the podcast here, where David Guetta, I think I don't say his name, but anyway, he's using Eminem. He's saying it's Eminem's voice. You know, he's also being very clear. It was generated by deep fake technology. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to get away? He's going to get away with that? I mean, I don't know. Well, maybe he's agreed. Eminem's maybe agreed.
So he probably agreed to it, but no. If he didn't agree to it, he could stop it. He could say, "Well, you're passing that off as me, and it's not me."
Even if you put the disclaimer created by a deep fake technology, probably still not going to pass the test.
Still have a problem.
Okay.
Because interesting. I mean, now if he's making fun of him, then he could argue that it's a parody, and it depends on how prominent it is, and there's a bunch of factors that you have to look at.
Interesting. Well, the other area I want to talk about in that same vein is derivative work. So again, researching this a lot, people are like, well, maybe it falls into the category of derivative work. So maybe you should like quickly talk about what are derivative works? How does that work? Anything to be learned from that in this context?
So I don't think it's that applicable, but a derivative work is where you start with a copyrighted work, and then you modify it in some way. So maybe you start with a famous book and you make it into a movie. The movie would be a derivative work of the book. Or you start with a famous book and you write book part two. That would be a derivative work. So here, I mean, some of the things we talked about could be considered derivative works. For example, the MLK image, where you took and you take a lot of other copyrighted images to create this bigger collage would be a derivative work comprised of lots of other copyrighted images.
And in that case, do they have any rights to your derivative work?
They may. It depends upon how derivative it is, okay, how much you changed it.
I see. So let's say that it were infringed. Let's say that they did have some claim to the derivative work. How do courts typically try and divvy up the profits coming from the derivative work? Is it proportional, or how does that work? How do you think about that?
Most likely not everyone would have sued. So not everyone's going to get money. It's just whoever the plaintiffs are.
I see.
But yes, they should take into account what percentage of the value of your work was derived from somebody else's work.
I see. And then imagine that I didn't use... let's say we take the collage again of MLK, and I didn't use 1,000 images. I used 100 million images. Well, even if I made $100 million off my derivative work, then you'd only be entitled to some proportional value of that, so maybe a dollar conceptually. Is that the way to think about it?
Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly, the court could do it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no, formula.
Okay.
What the court's going to try to do is attribute what portion of the value was attributable to your piece.
I see. And this is where it gets a little bit complicated then back to the ML case, because what I would say then if I were the actual defendant in this case, I would say, well, look, my model analyzed, 20 billion pieces of work, and no one of them is all that important to my model. In fact, your image could have been deleted from my model and it would have made no material difference to the output of said model. Now, in aggregate, my model doesn't exist without this. But in any one case, it actually is irrelevant. And right. so this creates this natural problem where in this world, unless you're a Getty Images or somehow you own a huge portion of the repository in which they were trained, it feels like they're going to have a difficult time actually enforcing any of those claims. Does that seem right to you, or you think there's a workaround here?
I think that's right, but I think I would, you know, when it comes to that, I would be more concerned from a contractual aspect than a copyright aspect. So if you pulled all your images from, I don't know, Facebook, for example, was one of your sources.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the Facebook contract says whenever you post a photograph, we own it, which I think it actually does say.
It does, yes.
Then you've actually stolen a lot of images that belong to one person.
Yeah.
So I would look at it more contractually. And also, even in relation to the other things we talked about, it's conceivable that if you changed laws where, say, oh, AI can be an author, you could be the guy who creates the AI engine and say, oh, and by the way, the terms of my thing say anything generated, I own.
Right.
And that would be legally enforceable.
Sure.
Yeah, that's more of a contract issue than a copyright one. So
how does this LinkedIn high Q case apply, which is this sort of, you know, canonical scraping, web scraping case where the courts are asked the question, like, even if I'm violating some terms of service, can I go scrape somebody's website? Do you think any of that logic will feed into this domain too or no?
Yeah, for sure. Because it's a contract question. Mm. So, you know, every violation of a contract does not necessarily give you damages. So there are other things you have to show. Yes, you do have to show that you agree to the terms of the contract, that the contract's enforceable, et cetera. But you also have to show, you have to quantify your damages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your burden if you're the one suing.
I see.
And so quantifying those types of damages can be very difficult.
Sure. How much does it cost when somebody hits an API on a web server, Jason?
I don't know. It depends on how poorly or well or poorly it's written.
Okay, last vein of questions here for you real quick. So again, it seems to me that there will be an unintentional infringement taking place at some point, at least as the laws are written today. The weird part to me is I don't know who's actually liable. Like, am I the person who wrote, let's say I'm doing a marketing campaign and I'm just a marketer and I say, hey, I want to go generate some copy for me. Oh, generate an image for me. And then I kind of paste it together. Am I liable? Is it the software that I used? Is it my company? Is it the person who wrote the AI? Is it the person who scraped the images and text to begin with? Like, who? There's a lot of people involved, lots of different legal entities. Who's ultimately liable in this case?
Yeah, so under copyright, whoever copied the image is liable, and it could be more than one person.
Oh, interesting.
So each person who copies that image is liable. So if you went and stole it off of somebody's website, okay, you violated copyright, and then you gave it to somebody else who then made a zillion copies on your whatever marketing materials, they're liable.
Mm-hmm. Got it. That seems problematic. Yeah. Any last questions, Jason?
No, it just, this whole thing, makes me want to head to happy hour, this whole discussion. it's been super helpful, and I really appreciate your time and putting up with all our questions, because, you know, it does help, at least in my mind, you know, maybe not clarify, but at least categorize the issues. There's like issues of people's building AI, right? And like, what there is that an invention and what their rights are. There are issues of, like, what did I use to train it? And is that a copyright, or are there contract issues? Is it, you know, and then people use that. It's like, well, what's the right amount of expression and who owns that work versus the people using it versus the AI itself? And it sounds like all of that is managed or governed right now by a certain set of laws in each country, all of which are subject to change, right?
Right.
And so, like, you know, it's a very thorny topic. And I think, you know, if we think, going back to the purpose of our podcast is like talking to business owners about what you should do. My only takeaway from that is like, consult an attorney, right? But with your idea before you go do it. I don't know. What would be your advice to a business owner?
Well, I think that's right. You would consult an attorney. And I think because of the uncertainty in the area of the law, probably what you would most likely want to do is to rely upon contracts.
Mm.
So if you're building these things, put in your contract who owns what and who has the IP in each thing, in the output, who has the IP in the actual system or programs.
Just be very explicit about that.
Yes, I think that's right.
So thanks so much for joining today. I really appreciate it. Any closing thoughts for you, Adam?
No, thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, appreciate it. For those of you who'd like to learn more, please visit the Insights page at Cordera.com. Subscribe to this podcast, and we'll put a link in the description to Adam directly if you have any more questions you want to follow up with him about. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join again.